You are listening to a digitally remastered class of Rav Yochanan Zweig, Rosh HaYeshiva of the Talmudic University of Florida. This class is from the Robert L. and Rhoda Lipton Foundation Audio Library. For more information, please call 305-534-7050, or you can visit our website at www.talmudicu.edu.
Today I want to talk about something which I think is the main message mothers should be giving, and the fathers too, but I think children really have to really grow up with this message, and it's really something that I think the mothers, it's even more important that the mothers give this message than the fathers, because it has to be really part of our whole being as Jews. I think it's a very, it's almost, I think, the a priori message. The most important message that we have to, our children have to internalize. And something like that is something that has to become from the mothers, because you have to hear it all the time, and from somebody you feel is, empowers you and you feel it has best interest at heart. It's a very, very important message. I want to begin by asking a question on a very simple sentence that we read many times during the year, many, many times. We had it this past Shabbos of the Torah, and literally makes no sense. Not that it makes no sense. Seemingly makes no sense. The few people I've mentioned it to say, I don't know why the question never bothered me. But it's, Klal Yisrael does the golden calf. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to Moshe, I'm furious with them, I'm going to destroy them and replace you with them. And the Moshe begins the following supplication to the Almighty. Hashem is furious about the golden calf. And he says the following thing. He begins supplicating. Vaychal Moshe's pnei Hashem vayomer, and he says to Hashem, "Lama Hashem yechera apcha b'mecha? Why are you so furious at your people that you took out of Egypt with so many miraculous evidences of your omnipotence?" First argument: what are you so angry about? The second: Lama yomeru Mitzrayim? Why will you give the opportunity for the Egyptians to say, if you destroy the Jewish people, you took the Jewish people out with a nefarious intention, that your original motive to take them out was to harm them? This is Moshe talking to Hashem. Assuming the Egyptians are rational people and reasonable people, they're going to accuse Hashem of taking Moshe out, of taking the Jewish people out in order to harm them. 3 million Jews leave. They go into a desert where there's scorpions and snakes, no food, no water. And Hashem gives them water. He gives them bread every day. He gives them meat every day. He has climate control. He has Anoni HaKovid protecting them, a whole environment of protection. He also has it in killing this, protecting them from the snakes and scorpions. It's unbelievable. 3 million people were in the desert, miraculous existence. And Klal Yisrael, they don't do something minor. They reject them, which the rabbis say idolatry is like adultery. And the language is Aluva Kalish Zinsam Mitochu Posa. They go to the wedding at Sinai, and God is giving them the Torah. You know, just next time you're at a wedding, just imagine as the bride and groom, you know, walk down after the ceremony, and all of a sudden the bride sees her old flame from high school and says goodbye and walks away. That's our sage's description, based on a pasuk in Shir HaShirim, of how the Jewish people acted. They're still at the wedding, and she goes off with her old boyfriend. That the Goyim will say Hashem took us out with nefarious motives. Doesn't make any sense. Moshe's not saying something stupid, but it sounds stupid. If you're going to kill them, what are the Goyim going to say? What are the Egyptians going to say? You took them out with evil intention. It doesn't make any sense. Do we agree with that? This is a sentence we say on every fast day, other times in the Torah. It makes no sense. We read this in every fast day in the Torah, and it was this week's parsha. I think it makes no sense. That's my question. I'd like to begin. Let's say your husband's making, after taxes, $500,000 a year. You're living nicely. You're paying your tuitions. You know, tuitions after tax, $500,000 a year. You travel a little bit. You don't have a private jet. But it's a very nice, you have a nice style of life. Actually, if you have to buy a house and pay a mortgage, you're making it. You're okay. You're making it. Even with the new taxes. You're making it. And all of a sudden, somebody comes and offers a opportunity. You have to move away. An opportunity where the salary will be $100 million a year. What would it take for a reasonable person to make that decision? Everybody likes $100 million more than $1 million, right? What would be, is there any downside to that?
That's not a downside, that's a good side.
Oh, okay. Let's put it like this. Let me just... You know, he get paid $100 million a year because it's a new startup company. The opportunity, and it's a reasonable chance it'll be successful. I'm not talking about, you know, pie in the sky. A reasonable chance it'll be successful. But the startup company may not be successful. You're now with a company that's been in business for, you're the CEO of a company or a big bank that's been in business for 100 years, and you have a certain amount of job security. And someone offers you $100 million a year, but no guarantee. What's the reasonable thing now to do?
Don't ask if it's in Florida.
If they'll pay my salary even for next 20 years, $1 million a year, that's okay. But how about if he doesn't say, you have a chance next year, you get a check for $100 million next to, or the bonus. But a reasonable person to say, listen, the upside's unbelievable, but I don't want to take that upside. Because I could lose everything, and if I'm not making a living, and someone offers me an upside, I run. But here we're not starting. I'm not making a living. I'm making a living and paying my bills and living comfortably. Not as high as possible to live. Maybe I can't give as much charity as I want. And there's a lot of other good things I can't do. I can't. On $500,000 a year, you're not going to be able to buy all your kids homes. So $100 million a year does us a different quality of living. But are you willing to risk a good standard of life living for an upside of $100 million? Now, I think the reasonable answer to that is no, of course not. And we know that's the reasonable thing. Hashem is giving us an enormous upside. We're living in Egypt. But you know what? What was the status of the Jews in Egypt at the end of, right before we went out? For a year, they haven't been working. When we want to borrow something from the Egyptians, we ask them for silver, gold. No, they, God, whatever it was showed his power, and they recognized they had done something wrong, and they're making amends to us. You want to borrow silver, take gold. You want one, take two. And not only that, the Torah, the scribes, when Moshe says, go borrow from them, he says, V'yishalu ish me'es re'ehu, v'ish me'es ru, so a woman should go to her friend. And a man should go to his friend, which means the Torah characterizes the Jews in Egypt after the slavery had ended, a year after, and after the plagues, they were almost, I guess, back to where they were before, you know, as an exalted people there, under the protection of Yosef and living in Goshen. They're almost back to that, because even though we were enslaved horribly for a long time, the Egyptians recognize the error of their ways. They consider us their friends. They lend us things. They're, and we're happy there. How do I know we were happy there? How do I know that we were very comfortable there? Because 80% of the people said we're staying here. Because we're doing the responsible thing. We're doing the responsible thing. And the responsible thing is to stay. They have the best medical care in the world, Egypt. It's the most progressive nation in the world, the wealthiest nation in the world, and we're now at the highest level of society. And they do feel, you know, it's not reparations, they do feel an enormous sense of they wronged us, and we're very comfortable there. Therefore, at this point, it's not reasonable to leave. What's Hashem doing? Hashem is offering us to go out, you know, but going to Israel, got to fight a few wars on the way, you have to displace 31 nations, maybe we won't merit all those miracles, maybe we'll fall down, we won't be as religious as we will, and we may not get it. You know, there's a great offer of a real relationship with Hashem and a tremendous upside, but it's not, nobody can be guaranteed, right? If Hashem's going to have to continue to make miracles for us in the desert, and then not only that, when we're fighting the 31 powerful nations in Israel, plus Sichon and Og, we have to maintain a very high level of spirituality that God should do those miracles for us. So it's not a slam dunk we're going to get that. It's a huge upside, but it's not a guarantee. Let's go back to the original case. You offer me a job. And this is, by the way, I would think 99% of all things, the issues that go to a Beit Din are this. I say, I know you're making $1 million a year. I'm offering you a job that very likely, and it's true, you'll make $100 million. I stop there. What do you think? How do you understand my offer? And if it doesn't, then I'm out of a job, or you'll continue the, I'll take care of you for the next 10 or 15 years, $100 million a year, $1 million a year. That's certainly the way you would like to understand my offer. And I say to myself, I never offered him guaranteed next 20 years $1 million a year. I offered him $100 million next year, and it's very reasonable. And that's usually, most disputes are, you want it to be your interpretation, and the other person wants their interpretation. How do you resolve that? How do you resolve that issue? Most agreements, we don't talk about the consequences, but you know, most people enter into a contract, think about what could be a consequence. Sometimes you bring it up on the table, or sometimes you say to yourself, I'm sure that he doesn't want me to not to have a job. And I say to myself, I'm sure he doesn't think that I'm going to give him $1 million a year. I'm offering them a possibility, and therefore we usually don't say anything. So now, how do you resolve that? You go to a Beis Din or a court, how do they resolve that? And the way they resolve that is, I know what I want, you know what you want. What does a third party disinterested think the deal was? The way you resolve this is, what does a reasonable man think the offer was? Does the reasonable man think the offer was $100 million plus a guarantee? Even though it wasn't said, because that's certainly the way you took it. Or does the reasonable person, the bystander, who doesn't have an agenda here, thinks when you offer somebody $100 million a year, that itself is to take the risk? It's an interesting question. We got to ask a bystander. You know what bystander we asked? Egypt. God is offering us an incredible relationship with Him in a land of our own, even from a political. It's a dream of hundreds of years of Jews, of Rome thinking about that, an unbelievable thing. But does that come along with a guarantee existence? Or, if the upside is so great, take your chances, take your risk. It wasn't talked out. What Moshe Rabbeinu was saying, Lama Yomru Mitzrayim, the objective person is going to say that if you didn't guarantee, then it was you did something evil. When you take a person from a job security, and They live in comfortably, even if you make the most stupendous offer. But if it doesn't have the security, a reasonable person wouldn't do that. Because it's, if I don't have a parnassa, I'll make a risk. But if I have a very nice parnassa, I'm not so obsessed, even though I'd like a lot of money, but so obsessed to risk every single thing I have for that. It doesn't make any sense. And therefore, if that's what you meant, God, that's evil. Well, the Egyptians say, when you have an issue that you're offering someone in a tremendous amount, but there's a possibility, as you're threatening God, I want to destroy them, zero, it's all gone, you're doing something evil, because everybody knows when someone is in a reasonable person, the Egyptians say, when someone is in a good situation, no matter how much you offer them, there has to be a minimum guarantee, because it's be very irresponsible to himself and to his family to take an offer like that. Why? They're in Egypt, they have somewhat of a relation with God, they'll be able to do daven and do as many mitzvahs as they want over here. Yes, it's not living in Israel, that's true, but there's no downside. Going with God to Israel requires such a high level of so many miracles and so many wondrous things that we're going to have to be on such an incredible level that we might lose it. So if you're not guaranteeing it, God, I got to be stupid to go. That's what the reasonable person says, and that's, by the way, what 80% of the Jews themselves felt. 80% of the Jews says we're not leaving. Because why are we not leaving? It doesn't make sense to leave because we can lose everything. That's what Paro would say too. And that's what an Egyptian would say. That's got Moshe Rabbeinu's offered argument to God. God, you want to destroy them? That's an evil intention. Because when someone is successful to take them, and no matter how great the offer is, if a person's successful and he can lose something that is really satisfying and works for him, then you've done something harmful. I don't care how much you told him and how much you promised and how likely it is. If there's a chance it's going to be lost, it's very, very irresponsible for him to act that way. And therefore, if you never meant that, it wasn't talked out. If you didn't mean that there's a guarantee, then you did something harmful and evil to them. That's the way the Egyptians would look at this. You did something harmful to them. And by the way, the Egyptians knew what they had done to us and the levels of discomfort in Egypt. On the other hand, they knew how it was today in Egypt. And therefore, they, based on what they would objectively say, no, that's evil, unless if you're going to destroy them, then that's evil. There has to be some security in the relationship. And the answer is that God, Moshe was right. And therefore, we have a guarantee. The way we have to understand Yetzias Mitzrayim is a guarantee of our survival. This relationship is forever. Now, of course, when you have an employee you can't fire, that's a two-edged sword. That's a formula for, and a lot of children take advantage with that, because a lot of children have the same feeling. My parents aren't going to get rid of me, and they take all kind of liberties. And we've heard of that, right? And if you haven't, just ask your mother. What it means here is an incredible thing. Yes. There's a guarantee the relationship will survive, but that doesn't mean there can't be punishments, estrangement, cutting salary. Because if you don't perform, I'm never destroying the relationship. I'm always giving you a chance to fix it up. Or if you want to fix it up, you will always have the opportunity. But until you fix it up, I can get tough, and I do get tough, and he did get tough with them. And by the way, this itself was the proof itself. Do you think this was an argument that Moshe Rabbeinu said on his own? Moshe said it, but what was the introduction? Listen, I'll read the sentence. God says, I saw what the people did, and they are stubborn. Leave me alone. I am furious with them. I am going to annihilate them, and I am going to make you a great king. make you a great nation. And then Moshe starts supplication. What are you so angry about, God? What would the Egyptians say? You're acting unreasonable. You can't threaten that there's no job security here. Listen to what God said to Moshe. Leave me alone. I'm furious with them and I want to destroy them. So Rashi says, what do you mean leave me alone? He should just go to Moshe and say, I plan on destroying them and I'm going to replace it. What do you mean? Why does God start his remarks to Moshe? Leave me alone. He's telling Moshe, he's giving him a license that if you don't leave me alone, I'm not going to be able to do this. He's suggesting and letting him know that he has a right to argue this, which means Hashem is using even now the idea that he wants this relationship to work. The most important message to our children is that Judaism is not a religion that's gone out of business in 50 years or 100 years, which, by the way, after the Second World War, there were people in this community who parents were not religious at all. And they sent them to the greatest universities in the country. And they came back with a Jewish girl. And the mother says, I didn't send you there to marry a Jewish girl. This is not anti-religious people. But they were, I think, after the Second World War, they wanted to be able to see children and grandchildren. And they weren't obviously religious people, but there was a feeling. Judaism is going to be a thing of the past. We just saw what happened. So how long will it be till there'll be a Hitler in America? I want to see that my grandkids are going to still be around. If you don't marry a Jewish girl, after a while, you know, we'll become part of the society. I don't want you to marry. It's just a sense that Judaism isn't forever. And the answer here is, and the most important message as Jews is, we have to know God is guaranteeing our continued existence, our continued relationship with Him if we want. Therefore, God does not have the option of getting rid of us. Because if God has the option that we want the relationship and He doesn't want, then taking us out of Egypt was a terrible thing to do to us. That was an evil thing. That's Moshe Rabbeinu's words. That's evil, to take somebody away from a secure position and to go ahead and offer them the world without security. Therefore, Yetzias Mitzrayim was predicated on the fact that we are guaranteed. If we want, Hashem will work with us. I don't mean that we can't not want. But if we want, guarantee that He's going to work with us. But again, doesn't mean that it's going to be without consequences. Punishments, threats. One of the smartest people in this community many years ago had a son. He himself was not a Sabbath observer, but his son used to come and daven in the yeshiva. So the yeshiva overlooked Goodyear. Especially the bathroom overlooked Goodyear. This boy, his father wasn't shul. You know, a kid can say 9, 10, he can't stay in shul all, you know, a long day. He was there for Shacharis, and when they read the Torah, I guess he went out or he took some breaks. He used to go in, take paper towels, wet them, throw them down, and if it goes on the windshield, it didn't break the windshield, but apparently it's very hard to get it off the windshield. And we had a very nice relationship with Goodyear. We needed it because we used to use their parking lot to come in. And it was a nice, so they were very, this is their business. And maybe there's 7 or 8 cars that take them hours to, and they called them. You know, the father's a supporter of the yeshiva. I don't tell the boy, don't come to shul anymore. I didn't know what to do. I called up the father. So, you know, having a little problem with your son. He's a very nice boy, but he goes out and... Listen to me, Rabbi. You can take him up, pick him up, turn him upside down. You can drop him on his head, just don't kill him. That was one of the smartest things that I ever heard of. It was like, that's exactly what God does to us. Yeah, sometimes He turns us upside down and He drops us on our head, but He doesn't kill us. He's not going to destroy us. That's exactly what the message that we went out of Egypt, but going out of Egypt is a commitment from God, which is this surfaces here. It's a commitment for God that if we want the relationship, it will forever endure. We still have to want it. And that's actually what the 13 attributes of mercy are now introduced. And the Talmud tells us something that sounds humorous. Moshe Rabbeinu had spent 40 days learning the whole Torah, the oral law. God is giving him some new information that there's 13 attributes of mercy, Hashem, Hashem, Keil Rachum. It's about 20 words. And how does Hashem teach him this? So the Talmud says, based on the sentences, in fact, it says if it wouldn't be written in this, if it wouldn't be written in the sentences, nobody could dare say it. God got dressed up like a chazan, put a talus over his head, and he told Moshe Rabbeinu, if you, and then he said the 13 attributes, and if you do this, Moshe, that'll help for the Jewish people. So my question is, Moshe went back to kindergarten. God was not able to tell Moshe an idea. He had to get dressed up with show and tell. What does it mean? He had to tell Moshe there's 13 words to say or 20 words to say, and you say it. And what do you mean God got dressed up, put a talus over his head, and said, do the following? Moshe couldn't understand. I think any of us could understand. Here's the four. These are the words. You should get the Jewish community together, and somebody leads it. What do you mean God had to get dressed up? It sounds like you're back in kindergarten. Not even first grade. That's kindergarten. The answer is, God is not telling us that if we say these 13 attributes were forgiven, God is leading the community. That's His agenda. He's leading us in saving the relationship. He's not telling us that we can save the relationship. He's acting on our behalf that the relationship should be saved. He's our advocate. That's really the deficit, right? If God, when you send a chazan, he's davening for you and for us, and he's praying for us, and he's our agent to make sure our agenda is fulfilled, that God won't destroy us. You know who our biggest agent is? The Almighty Himself. He's our biggest agent. That's the guarantee of what going out of Egypt is. And actually, this is a message that we learn from here. But Rashi says, in the original covenant, when God told Abraham, you're going to go into slavery, your children for 400 years, and at the end of that time, the nation that enslaves you, I will punish. It says, V'gam es ha'goy asher yavodu, the ones that enslave you, don anochi, I'm going to punish. And Rashi says, with the 10 plagues. That was what God told Abraham. So Rashi wants to know, what does it mean, and also the nation? You'll be enslaved for 400 years, and the nation will be punished. What do you mean, gam? So Rashi says, gam means not only the Egyptians, but all the nations that follow. God will react to and punish. And God will do everything possible to maintain our relationship. And that's what we actually say in the Haggadah. B'chol dor v'dor omdim aleinu l'chaloseinu. In every generation, we get up and there's people out there who are ready to annihilate us. V'kodesh boruch hu matzileinu, He saves us. How do we know that? So I'm saying from here we see that. That was the whole story of the eagle. But actually it's even hinted to in the original going down that God will react against all the future generations who start up with us. And just to take it a step further, and this is, I think if all of us were sitting here, we're having a rational discussion, let's forget about religion. We're having a rational discussion just as students of political science and history. How many nations in the world today will have the capacity that they have today or in 5 years from now to push a button to annihilate the land of Israel? In 5 minutes. Probably, I don't know how long it takes for a missile to go from Iran, Syria. Does it, anybody believe rationally, if you're a student of history or you're a student of political science, that we can survive, forget about 50, 20 years? There's no rational way that we can believe that we're going to survive. It can't possibly be. It can be. It's so against logic. Therefore, I say all of us and our children, surely, start with a feeling, this is a business that's going out of business. You know, we're just waiting for the sign to be, you know, going out of business. The Jews are going out of business. And when you have a feeling of going out of business, why should we dedicate our lives to learning? Why should we dedicate our lives to doing mitzvahs? Why should we dedicate our lives to Jewish values? We're going out of business. This is a relic. That is what a rational person begins. I think there's no rational person who's looking objectively, not convinced that we're going out of business. You know what that does to my commitment to do mitzvahs, my commitment to follow the ways of Hashem? We're going out of business. We need to get the message that we know with 100% certainty that the Almighty has guaranteed that we're staying in business. And by the way, we can add this part to the children, which is actually what the Baal HaGadah also says. Just like we're knowing we're going out of business, what were we in 1945? 6 million Jews. In fact, I hear there's a new statistic. They've done some studies. The Holocaust was even worse than was imagined. That's like the latest. They're doing research. They know it was even worse. But 6 million Jews, and the few that survived were scarecrows. They lost their humanity. They lost, emotionally broken. The survivors, I'm talking about, emotionally broken, physically broken. There's all kind of support groups for the children of survivors, too. It's a huge. And what happens? In 60 years, we're nothing. We're broken. And we started a little country over there, surrounded by 150 million, at that time 130 million people that are hell-bent on our destruction. And what happens, despite that, despite the fact we started with nothing, despite the fact that we are emotionally broken and everything else, we've emerged in 65 years as a world power economically, as a world power militarily, in science, medicine, off the charts, especially in relationship to anything else. That can't be. It's impossible. There's no human being that can explain that. There's no one who could have thought that would have happened, because just like we know in 20 years we're out of business, what did people think when you're surrounded by 130 million Arabs in 48? How long is this state going to be? 5 years? 10 years? They're just going to walk in and kill us over. We're not short of other enemies too, besides our immediate neighbors. And we thrive, and we're not doing everything right. We're far from doing everything right. So we actually have from history a proof, which is what the Baal HaGadah says too. Shebechol dor v'dor omdim aleinu l'chaloseinu. They're standing up to annihilate us. We've seen that in our lifetime. And just like they were not able, and I don't know how that's possible. I have no idea. How is it possible that we weren't annihilated in the last 60 years? 130 million is already, they just had to walk in and they could have killed us. Good, they would have lost 10 million people or 20 million people. But we would have been out of business. We would have been, the Almighty protected us, but not only protected us, thrived in an incredible way. An incredible way, with Nobel Prize winners and more people studying Torah than ever. Everything that couldn't be, especially from people that have been just ravaged, raped, destroyed, maimed, crippled. God did it. This is the message we have to give over to our children. Just like this happened, it's going to always happen. I don't know the answer, and I can't even imagine how the solution is going to happen. And even after it happens, I don't know how it happened. How did it happen that we weren't destroyed in Israel? How did it happen? There's no, it's not like the rest of the world. Forget about the Arabs around us. We have plenty of Sinim besides the Arabs. Europe, we have plenty. Africa, we have plenty of Sinim. It's a few people that hate us, that want to destroy us. Not just our Arab friends. It's the rest of the world too, for the most part, want to do. And that's the most important. And I said, that's something you have to hear from your mother. That's something you have to grow up with. And that has to become embedded in our being. Because once we lose sense that we're here forever, we don't have much of a connection to anything. I don't. Why should I do this if I know I'm not going to be around? And why should I have a lifestyle that I know can't be maintained? Why should I teach my children Torah that they're not going to be able to maintain? They're not going to be interested in the Jewish people's history. Therefore, the most important message to give our children is our survival is guaranteed. Hashem will punish us, and we have plenty. And right now, we're living under threats. We have plenty of other threats. We just went through Purim, which we had even a bigger threat. An immediate threat, and a decree already passed. But at the end of the day, it's incredible the way we've grown and thrived and survived. That's the most important message, that if we want continuity, nobody can think we're going out of business. And I think part of the problem with the secular Jews is they don't understand that. They don't have that same security that we have. And therefore, what they've adopted is a very interesting strategy. They've adopted the strategy that I want to survive. I'll take the values of Jews, of Judaism, which is not going to be much of a Jewish religion anymore, but I'll take those Jewish values and I'll start promoting liberal causes. So when we all become goyim, I will have made an important statement, and I will have important values, and I'll be an important contributor to liberal values, and therefore they won't kill us. That's what I think their strategy is. They know Judaism is surviving, but people that promote liberal causes, at least in a country like America, and liberal values and healthy values and important social values, those people are going to survive. So we won't survive as Jews, but we'll take the message of Judaism and give us our survival. With us, we know that we have to survive as Jews. And the guarantee from God, we will. Everybody should have a great Shabbos.